I was working as a sports mascot. I was working as a teacher's aide, as a tutor. I was working at one point as a debating adjudicator. I've been working for the uni for a little while as well.
Uni students know all too well what life is like living on a budget. For some, there is government financial assistance up for grabs. But there are calls for changes to the system to prevent regional students in particular falling through the cracks. And after weeks stranded hundreds of kilometres from country, residents from the remote Western Australian community of Junjunjara are finally on their way home.
Every day people here are asking about when people are coming home and vice versa. People have just been stranded. So people are really genuinely looking forward to finally coming home.
I'm Michelle Stanley and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Nullama Country, Karratha. Kicking off in New South Wales, because from today, parts of Kosciuszko National Park will be closed to the public as an aerial shooting program gets underway. The program will target brumbies and other feral animals, but it's had a mixed reaction. From Bega, reporter Adrian Reardon has been following the developments. Adrian, how much of the park will be closed?
Michelle, 20% of the park will be closed in the northern section, so not the entirety of Kosciuszko. It is a part of it, and arguably it is one of the more popular areas of Kosciuszko National Park compared to the south, that is. But it is important to note, as part of this aerial culling program that's taking place as of today through until October 4, so that is 6 months, all major ski resorts and tourism areas will remain open during that time. So Mount Kosciuszko as well, but Perisher, Redbow, Charlotte Pass, Selwyn Snow Resort, Yarrangabilly Caves and certain sections of walks, like including the recently completed Snowy East Alpine Walk. You can go on to the National Parks website and actually get a specific breakdown of which campgrounds are closed, which ones are actually still open and walking tracks and to that effect as well in much greater detail. But National Parks has kept in mind that some of the more popular areas will remain open despite this temporary closure.
Now, this closure is for a program to manage feral horse numbers in the park. Well, what does that program involve?
So the aerial culling program that's taking place at the moment was actually brought back in as an additional method in order for the New South Wales government to reach its goal by law to reduce the feral horse population in Kosciuszko to 3,000 by mid-2027. The most recent survey estimates that more than 17,000 feral horses remain in the park and that they are having a severe impact on the natural and cultural values of Kosciuszko National Park, that the fragile alpine ecosystem is threatened by these hard-hoofed animals. So the goal is to reduce them to 3,000, and that's also balancing the fact that there is a heritage value to these brumbies. The New South Wales government has acknowledged that and are reducing them to keep 3,000 in the park. But that method of aerial shooting was reintroduced late last year in a bid to tackle that goal in time. Aerial shooting isn't the only method being used. Ground shooting is another, tranquilizing, euthanasia and rehoming. As of 2021, when the management plan was first introduced, more than 900 brumbies have been rehomed. So there's a variety of methods on the table here, and aerial shooting is currently being used in the park. This six-month closure is related to aerial culling in particularly. Brumbies will be targeted along with feral deer and pigs.
This comes up time and time again, and it's controversial every single time we hear it. What's been the latest reaction to the closure?
Mixed, as per usual. You're right, this has been an ongoing controversial issue. We have heard from pro-Brumby advocates, we've heard from environmentalists and conservationists. We didn't get to this stage out of the blue, though. This particular aerial survey, this latest one prompting the six-month closure, there was more than 2 months' notice given to neighbours and businesses that could potentially be impacted by it. You know, we were first told about it back in January, so there has been a bit of a heads up on a local level. In terms of, though, I guess there has been a lot of support for the plan in itself. I did catch up with David Bell from Bushwalkers New South Wales. He's the president there, just to get his thoughts on the closure and, you know, what he makes of it. He does actually support the plan. He does think that maybe a marginal few people that use that area of the park may be impacted. But he says most bushwalkers head into Kosciuszko during the green season, which runs from October through to April. So the impact should be quite low. And at the end of the day, bushwalkers go to the park predominantly to see the native species, which he would like to see protected.
Well, we support that current plan. We think it's ambitious. But we do support what National Parks is doing. And we see aerial culling as something you would prefer not to do. But in the circumstances, we think it's an effective measure to get the size of the herd down. Horses are a big deal in terms of the park. I've had personal experiences of being hassled by horses in the park. There are simply too many of them. So there's an issue there of interactions with people. But also the animals, the horses are impacting on the environment of the Kosciuszko area. We have impacts on some of those waterways, trampling of bogs, and that has an impact on species like the corroboree frog and the broad-tooth rat. The current numbers of horses are affecting not just the environment and conservation values of the park, they're also affecting recreation values.
So a level of support there from David Bell, the president of Bushwalking New South Wales. Adrian Reardon, what have you heard from those who are opposed to this aerial culling program?
Yeah, there's a number of protesters that actually took to Kosciuszko National Park on Easter Sunday, about 400 of them, some on foot, some on horseback, that were protesting against this closure. They also were against aerial shooting. That was led by Dick Roberts, who's based out at Tumbarumba. And they just felt that there wasn't enough consultation done in relation to this, and they didn't support aerial shooting in general. In response to that, though, National Parks has reiterated the fact that when they did seek public consultation on their proposal last year to reintroduce aerial shooting, which has now been accepted, it was extensive. They received more than 11,000 public submissions on that proposal, and of those that did comment on aerial shooting specifically, the majority backed it. Separately, last year there was a Senate inquiry examining the impacts of feral horses across Australia's Alps. So that included New South Wales Snowy Mountains along with Victoria and the ACT. And one of the recommendations that was handed down as part of that Senate inquiry was that aerial shooting be used in Kosciuszko as a control method. So there has been a lot of support out there to use aerial shooting, but of course we have heard from the other side as well. The other person that we've heard from this is Emma Hurst, who is a member of the Animal Justice Party, and she's also the chair of a New South Wales Upper House inquiry examining the use of aerial shooting in the park. She was disappointed from the get-go that the New South Wales government decided to adopt aerial shooting as an additional control method, despite her inquiry still being underway. We can expect a report probably in the next 6 to 8 weeks in relation to that. So that will be quite interesting. But yeah, there's been years of political talk, public talk about this particular issue. And the New South Wales government has gone ahead as a priority to use aerial shooting as one means to get those numbers down in time by law.
And no doubt we'll continue to hear years more on this. Adrian Reardon, thanks for your time on Australia Wide today.
Thanks for having me.
ABC Australia Wide.
Michelle Stanley with you. Even before we found ourselves in this cost of living crisis, the time spent at university are notoriously the brokest years of your life. For plenty of students across Australia, those uni years are spent living off a diet of two-minute noodles and cheap coffee, likely in a rundown share house which is packed to capacity. Depending on your circumstance, there is financial assistance available from the government, but the rules are strict and often don't account for individual circumstance. And unfortunately, this means some students fall between the cracks of a system that just wasn't designed for them. Our reporter Louise Mylan has been looking into this issue. Louise, what are the current rules for Centrelink's youth allowance? Who's eligible and who isn't?
Yeah, hey Michelle. So basically, for most cases, there are two ways Centrelink looks at you. You're either dependent or you're independent. You're automatically classed as dependent until you turn 22, and there are ways around that that we can get into. But if you're independent, you're entitled to the full Centrelink amount, which I think is $639 a fortnight, no questions asked. But if you are dependent, that means your parents' income is taken into account when you're sussing out your eligibility. So you might still get some money, but your parents' income will play a role in determining how much money that is, even if you don't live with them.
Okay, so what determines whether or not someone has financial independence from their parents?
So basically, you can turn 22. That'll count you as independent and you don't have to worry about your parents' income anymore. Or you can work for 30 hours a week for 18 months over a two-year period. And that's what most students from regional areas do. They take a gap year so that they can fulfill the work requirements so that their parents' income doesn't have to factor into their Centrelink at all.
I remember my sister doing that, actually. It is really common for people from regional Australia. So if people are considered dependent, what level of financial assistance are they able to receive from Centrelink?
Yeah, so you can still get Centrelink if you're dependent on your parents. It's just that your parents' income will have to be considered when you're figuring out how much it is. So there's this thing, it's called the parental income free area, which is currently around just over $60,000 a year, I think. So if your parents earn under that, you'll get the full Centrelink benefit. And then after that amount, it starts to be reduced depending on how much your parents earn. And there are like lots of factors to do with family circumstances and other things that'll determine how much it's reduced by. And it was actually really hard to clarify this, but I eventually got a response from Services Australia. And they told me that this year, in 2024, the parental income cutoff is around $122,000 for students living at home and $146,000 for families with kids who have to move away to study. So if your parents earn above that amount, it's possible that you won't get a cent of Centrelink, even if you're not living with them, even if they're not paying your rent.
Right. That all seems pretty confusing.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, like your sister, like most of the people I grew up with as well, it's, you know, you have to do these crazy things to qualify. But on top of that, it's confusing to figure out the rules. You know, and when you're 18 and you're moving out of home for the first time, sometimes you're moving hundreds or thousands of Ks away from home to study. It's like, it's pretty stressful.
So how does this affect regional students in particular? Does it put them at a disadvantage?
Yeah, well, lots of people say that it does because of that thing we just talked about the gap year, right? So there are obviously advantages. When I have spoken to young people about this, they say, you know, there are perks to having a gap year and working. But on the whole, it's just something that for a lot of Metro students, they don't have to do because they can actually live at home and they can rely on that family home to be able to study. But regional students need youth allowance. They need Centrelink to be able to make the move to the city. Yeah, so I spoke to quite a lot of students about this. This is Jack. He's originally from Launceston. He's now living in Hobart. And because of his parents' income, he's not eligible to Centrelink.
I was working as a sports mascot. I was working as a teacher's aide, as a tutor. I was working at one point as a debating adjudicator. I've been working for the uni for a little while as well. This current system does disproportionately disadvantage students in remote and regional areas.
So Jack has done a whole heap of different things to try and get through that and get around that quirk of the system, I suppose. And Louise, the Australian University Accordion's recently released a report with a whole host of recommendations that's looking at ways to improve the tertiary education sector, a number of which looked at accessibility for regional students. Was this Centrelink issue something that was addressed in the report?
Yeah, it was addressed. So the report recommended lifting that parental income free area that we spoke about earlier. They recommended lifting that slightly. The report didn't go so far as to recommend lowering the age of independence entirely, like lowering it from 22. But I spoke to Regional Education Commissioner Fiona Nash. She helped author the report, and she acknowledged that these rules around independence really are impacting regional students.
We know it's around $30,000 a year for those regional families to support their students, the cost of actually them having to leave home because they have no choice to attend university. So I think it's something that the government should look at very, very closely. There's a real inequity between city students and rural and regional and remote students in accessing tertiary education.
So what are advocates for regional students saying needs to change, Louise?
A few different things. So there's the National Union for Students. They want the age of independence lowered from 22 to 18, regardless if you're regional or metro. They say that when you turn 18, you should be classes independent. Your parents' income shouldn't factor into how much youth allowance you get. There are other groups as well, like the Isolated Children's Parents Association. They don't go so far as to call for it all to be lowered to 18, but they do say there should be more consideration for regional students who have to take those gap years and fulfil all those requirements.
Reporter Louise Mylan.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
There's actual hope for the industry that we can have a proper functioning market where if consumers pay more, farmers can get a bit more. It just seems fair and logical.
On ABC Radio.
Parts of New South Wales and Queensland are on high alert, with a major rain event expected to engulf most of eastern Australia over the next couple of days. Rainfall totals of up to 200 millimetres are forecast to end the week, and flood watches are in place from central Queensland to southern New South Wales. Meanwhile, in Western Australia's remote goldfields, residents from a remote community are finally on their way home after weeks cut off by washed out roads. A deluge of rain last month rendered the roads to Junjara impassable. It's a remote community about 650 kilometres northeast of Kalgoorlie. But yesterday, a special flight landed to reunite locals. From Kalgoorlie Boulder, Julia Battolio has this story.
After weeks cut off from their homes, finally residents of Junjara can return.
Quite a number of people who've been down in Kalgoorlie for different reasons, for medical or they've maybe have just come out of hospital, come to see family, and the rain came so suddenly to close the roads.
Tracy McCartney is from Kalgoorlie's Church of Christ M25 support hub. She's been assisting vulnerable people from remote communities stranded due to floods.
They're stuck here and it's really hard, and I don't think people really understand that there's so many people that are stuck and longing to be back home. They don't want to be here for this long.
We feel worried. We're worried for our families, sleeping rough and tan. We come back here where it's safer. I got an auntie there and she got a little grandson here. She got to come back home to look after him.
Despite the distances, travelling between the remote goldfields communities and the outback town of Kalgoorlie is a regular occurrence for some. But last month's rainfall has severely damaged the roads, making them impassable and leaving people stranded hundreds of kilometres from home. Until yesterday, when one of four special flights landed in Junjara.
It was fantastic news.
John Lark is the CEO of Popiala Jaruja Aboriginal Corporation that manages the community on behalf of the Spinifex people. They've been calling for help to get residents home for weeks. He says the flights are a huge relief.
The Department of Social Security in Canberra have released enough funds for about four planes. This was brought about by some great work from the City of Kalgoorlie Boulder, who've been really helpful throughout this whole process. Two planes this week, and then we'll see where we go from there. So in the next 2 days, we'll have 18 people, and I've got another list of about 12 people that are looking for flights.
What does that mean for the people finally travelling back home and for the entire community at Junjara?
Every day people here are asking about when people are coming home and vice versa. So people are really genuinely looking forward to finally coming home.
Because of the significant rainfall and damage, it's expected to be some time before roads are reopened.
There is one section of road there which remains as a very large lake, if you like, over a metre deep and perhaps a kilometre long. Before that dries out, it's going to be weeks and weeks. And then after that, they're going to need to do significant work on other sections where the roads dropped out by a metre.
But after a three-day search rescued a lucky family attempting the drive during last month's rain, John Lark is urging people not to risk the journey to Junjara.
People are assuming from their lifetime of experience that once the rain has passed, the road is passable. But because this is such a once-in-a-lifetime event, I don't think people comprehend the extent to which it's still underwater. It's still quite amazing, quite shocking, really. And so it is a concern to us that people may persist until they get stuck again.
Julia Battolio from Western Australia's Goldfields with that report. You're listening to Australia Wide, coming from the Pilbara today. I'm Michelle Stanley. Finally today, talking about your personal health can be a struggle for some people, particularly those living in the bush, like John Carter. But that changed for John after finding himself confronted with his own health scare. He suffered a heart attack, and he's not alone. Heart disease accounts for 8.9% of health conditions in the Wonthaggi area, which is more than double the Victorian average. Since recovering from his own experience, John now leads a peer support group for people with heart disease, encouraging them to share information and support one another through their recovery.
When John Carter developed a dry, hacking cough in 2022, he had no idea it was a sign of heart failure.
And the wise coughing was because my heart was incapable of removing the build-up of fluid within my body, and as a result, my lungs were filling up with fluid, and that's the reason why I was coughing all of the time. I've had open-heart surgery. I've also had a punctured lung, which also required another visit to the Alfred Hospital, and I've also had an ablation, which is that procedure that corrects an irregular heartbeat.
Many others in Mr. Carter's Bass Coast region of Victoria experience troubles with their heart health. 2021 census data shows heart disease accounted for 8.9% of all long-term health conditions in Wonthaggi, more than double Victoria's average of 3.7%. The National Health Survey 2022, which was released late last year, found people living in inner regional Australia were more likely to have heart, stroke and vascular disease than those in major cities. Christian Verdicchio is the Chief Executive of Heart Support Australia, the peak national body supporting Australians affected by heart disease through peer support. He says once regional cardiac patients finish rehabilitation, they're usually left on their own.
Our peer support groups are really designed to capture people that once they finish up, perhaps within the hospital setting, to bring people in to have some education, but at the same time, talk to one another to talk about symptoms or issues they may be experiencing, not just even with the condition, but perhaps even navigating the healthcare system afterwards.
Mr. Carter wanted to help others when his health allowed. So when he was asked to lead a peer support group in Wonthaggi, he jumped at the opportunity.
It gives one another the sense of belonging, I guess, to a group within the community that can swap stories about our own and particular events and episodes and things like that, and how we felt and how we feel now. By talking about it with one another, we're actually making ourselves a lot stronger mentally.
Dr. Verdicchio says most of the peer support groups are in regional areas where cardiac patients face added challenges accessing help.
We know GPs are quite hard to come across. We know typically cardiologists want to see their patients once a year afterwards, and you know, some cardiologists in the regions would travel, you know, maybe once a month for a clinic. So the regions and the rural Australians do face some significant inequalities.
Director of the Victorian Heart Institute at Monash University, Stephen Nichols, says regional communities face higher rates of heart disease due to a range of complex issues.
Well, I think the first is distance. The reality is that we don't have cardiologists and cardiac surgeons sitting on every street corner in every town in regional Australia. So it's a distance to get to see somebody. It takes time to get into people, see people. If you have an acute problem, if you're having a heart attack, we need to get you to hospital. We need to get you to emergency treatment as quickly as possible. If that involves having to go to a cath lab and having an invasive procedure and having a stent put in, well, that's not going to happen in most regional parts of Australia. That's going to involve being put in the back of an ambulance or a helicopter and taken somewhere like the heart hospital. There are just inherent barriers there. We also know that the rates of heart disease are simply higher. They're higher in regional communities. They're higher in communities that are doing it tougher from an economic perspective. You know, we know that chronic stress becomes an issue. We know that bushfires are issues. We know that the climate and environment is becoming a bigger issue in terms of how it affects heart disease and the risks of that. And so, you know, all of those issues, they're all just much more prevalent in regional communities than they are in metropolitan areas. And so they're simply going to create a much larger challenge.
Stephen Nichols is the director of the Victorian Heart Institute at Monash University, and he's also a patron of Heart Support Australia. Ending that report from Georgia Lenton Williams. That's Australia Wide for this Thursday. I'm Michelle Stanley. I'll catch you tomorrow.